know, it's not hard as a GM to kill players. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not hard as a GM to kill characters. Depends on how strong you are and how strong your players are. Live from the Mundangerous Farm upstate with plenty of room to run and play, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 24 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about character death, how to handle it, what to do when it occurs, and how to make it meaningful. But first, the Morning Glory campaign finds out exactly how bad their situation really is. And later, we build a knight on horseback in the Character Creation Forge.
On horseback?
We'll get there. There are lots of options for mounts.
So, coming back from the holidays, this is the first episode we're recording in 2016. We ran the holiday one-shot over the break.
You ran the holiday one-shot.
Yeah. So, it got all screwed up. It was supposed to be run on December 30th, and then my flights returning home got all messed up, and
I was... That's what you get for flying Ryanair.
Yeah. And I was at my dad's house, and he has satellite internet, which was somehow slower than my phone. So I couldn't even get the game up and running beforehand to make character. Like, it was a comedy of errors how many things went wrong. So we ended up having to reschedule it. I apologized to everybody who was originally signed up, and then I had to bail on you. But we ended up, I think we had a blast.
I mean, I guess we could probably do another game in the future, but how did it go? Do people even want to do another one?
Oh, well, I don't know. You'd have to ask them. But I had fun. I wanted to do something in the middle of Out of the Abyss, sort of not a first level thing. And then just because of the technical difficulties and the internet restrictions and the rescheduling and everything, I ended up just running the intro, the very first encounter kind of situation. So
did people build characters or did you supply pregens?
Yeah, so everyone built a character, but it was level one, so not a big deal. Mm-hmm. Or maybe level two. The bigger problem was that I had some technical difficulties on the Fantasy Grounds end, so we ended up having to run it through Hangouts.
Oh, no.
I was using the adventure from Fantasy Grounds, but having to I was tracking everything there, but I was actually running it technically offline. So it was amusing. But it worked. I mean, it's a fun intro scenario. It's kind of a break out of prison situation. And there's a lot of NPCs that have really good characterization. So it was fun to be able to interact. Though I think maybe for a one-shot, it was a little overwhelming to just suddenly be throwing all these NPCs at you and be like, all right, we got 4 hours to figure out who's useful and get out.
Right, because, you know, this is supposed to be the beginning of some sort of grand campaign.
Right, yeah. I would definitely recommend if you're running Out of the Abyss, don't run the intro area in one session. Go ahead and build that up over like two or three, yeah.
Or maybe just fast forward to one of the sort of more generic combats.
Yeah. I had fun. I mean, we had three players. Thank you to Russell, who was super flexible. He was signed up for the original game and then made it work, even though it was like 8 a.m. his time in Australia. And then Corey and Christopher joined as well at the last minute. Like, I talked to them 2 hours before we started. So I was on the verge of canceling the game, and it ended up working out great.
Sweet.
And then thank you to Fantasy Grounds for providing the adventure and the software. I am actually in a new Fantasy Grounds campaign, so I'll have a lot more practice with Fantasy Grounds, which is nice, because the more time I spend in it, the more I like it.
Nice. So let's get to the Morning Glory recap. At this point, the party is chasing Nishtam Shadar in Metrol just hours before the Day of Mourning. Remember, they've been sent back in time by what they assume is Cube, Primus. They tracked Nishtam to a crypt in a graveyard and triggered a trap where they were trapped inside a force cage and then the entire tomb collapsed on top of them. And the force cage is now holding up the collapsed ceiling. They don't have a way out, so fortunately they're able to contact Aaron DeCaneth, and he sends over his manservant, warforged bot servant.
Yeah, his like warforged
his
attendant?
Yeah.
His adjutant or his
There we go. Yeah. There we go. Regulus.
Right.
The Warforged, who comes over and uses a disintegrate to free you, and you're all high enough level, you're able to sort of slip out from, you know, falling rubble.
So, but that name is important, right? Regulus? This isn't the first time we've heard that name.
Yes, when you met the Shade of Aaron DeCaneth, he said that Regulus had abandoned him. So when you met Regulus, you went, interesting. There's going to be some sort of falling out here, but what could that be?
Well, we also know why Regulus abandoned him, or at least how, in what way he abandoned him.
You had a pretty good idea of it, yes.
Yes, our good old friend, the Lord of Blades, in the Mornland, in the ruined remains of Metrol, who we had a brief but harrowing encounter with on the run from.
He shot you in the liver.
He did, yes. As we escaped from the lightning rail station in Metrol to this buried Caneth facility, which kind of kicked off this whole arc.
Yeah. For those of you who play Eberron, you know that all Warforged have a symbol on their forehead. It's called a Gulra, and it's sort of like a fingerprint. It's unique to every individual Warforged, and you guys happen to notice from the sneaking glimpse you caught of the Lord of Blades, his Gulra matches Regulus's.
Well, you never forget the Gulra of the man who shoots you in the liver.
It's true. But at this point, Regulus seems to be very friendly. In fact, almost obsequious. He comes running to help you, uses a disintegrate scroll, helps get all of you out of the tomb, and then takes you all back to the tower so that you can regroup, lick your wounds, and really sort of turn on Aaron DeCaneth and go, okay, give us the whole story. What's actually going on here?
Yeah.
And he says, well, one thing you should know, Primus is gone. He's been called away to Whitehall, an emergency.
And what is Whitehall?
It's one of the more secretive Caneth facilities. When the party was beneath Sharn in that abandoned facility, they got the coordinates of three locations in the Mornland that they believe were sort of the beginnings, the epicenters of the Day of Mourning. One was Metrol, where they are now. One is Esten, which is another town to the west. And Whitehall, a secret facility they believe was rumored to be located somewhere in the center of the country. So Primus has been called away to Whitehall for undisclosed reasons. Aaron says it's an emergency, but he either doesn't know or is unwilling to say exactly what's going on. Of course, at this point, the party has plenty of questions, and they say, no, tell us what's actually going on here. There's a huge battery full of angels and fiends beneath this facility. What exactly are you doing?
Yeah, excuse me. Now is the time for a little exposition.
And he says, okay, fine. I'll level with you, considering we need to go find Nistrum Shadar. He tells you about the disjunction, which you had learned from his shade in the future, that it is a legendary spell that destroys magic. So unlike dispel magic, which just ends ambient magic that is currently around, or an anti-magic field, which suppresses all magic temporarily, a disjunction permanently destroys a magical effect or a magical item. And those of you who've played previous editions know Mordenkainen's disjunction, right? It was a 9th level spell, and it would completely destroy a magic item. It even had the chance to destroy artifacts. But it doesn't exist in 5e.
Yet.
Right. We'll see what happens.
Because Mordenkainen doesn't exist, because Greyhawk doesn't exist yet.
That's right. The other thing Aaron does for you guys is he confirms a heresy of the Silver Flame that Brand had heard about. And I don't know that Brand had necessarily shared this with the party yet.
I think at this point, this is where Brand was sort of spending some time back and forth, kind of collecting information. Spent a lot of time at the library, and certainly after this, mm-hmm. He spends a ton of time at the library. But yeah, there were some rumors that Brand had kind of heard circulating in the top secret section.
Yes. So the Keeper of the Flame, sort of the Pope of the Silver Flame, communes with the Flame and the Coatl and the Paladin trapped therein. But there are people who say that the Demon Lord, also bound within the Flame, sometimes speaks to people. The Shadow in the Flame, so they say. And Aaron DeCaneth says, oh yeah, yeah. His name's Belshalor, the Shadow in the Flame. He's a fiendish overlord from the Age of Demons trapped by the Silver Flame in Kyber, and we're going to kill him.
You can imagine why that wasn't so... such a great idea to Brand.
Maybe it would have sounded like a better idea if you guys didn't already know that it didn't work.
I mean, that's true, yeah. It's like offering to kill your god, you know, for fun.
But to kill a worse god, you know, it's a trade-off.
Right, right. And then also sacrifice. When you know it won't work, and it will make things way worse.
Right. So Aaron says that's the reason Primus came to the material plane here in Eberron in the first place, right? Primus is this being of like great power and order, and Bel-Shalor, the Shadow and the Flame, is this force of chaos. Aaron insinuates that the last war was sort of going on for so long, partially because of the machinations of Bel-Shalor. So their plan is mass disjunction to disjunct the Silver Flame, sort of turn it off for a bit, that releases the bound demon lord, and then Primus knows Bel-Shalor's true name and can use it to slay him. Great plan.
Sure.
On paper. On parchment.
That didn't stop us from trying to convince him not to do that.
Yeah. He was not convincible, but you already knew that.
Yeah. I mean, Primus was... No, you're incorrect. My calculations are perfect. There can be no mistake here.
Essentially, yeah. So instead of trying to convince them, you say, well, we know what's going to happen. Let's see if we can stop it or make it not nearly as bad. Or, I mean, some of you were like, let's just go see what happens.
I can tell you from my perspective, from Bran's perspective, I had a sneaking suspicion that we would end up causing the Day of Mourning. But at the end of the Day of Mourning worked out much better for the Silver Flame and for Thrain than it did for anybody here in Metrol or in Seer. So,
right, from the perspective of people living in Thrain, the Thrainish knights who were fighting a five-way war with Seer. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I figured, let's make sure nothing worse happens than the Day of Mourning, right?
You were kind of thinking, let's make sure it doesn't go off as planned.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, truthfully, I didn't want to actively sabotage it because I mostly kind of believed what was happening.
And of course, you had, you know, an angry paladin going, no, we're definitely going to stop
it. Yeah, so I was along for the ride. Yeah, and so I think that was the mix of the party. It was, no, we must stop this. Let's see what happens. And then, like, if it comes down to me pulling the switch or not, I don't think I'm going to pull it.
Which it would have been amazing. You and Kallik with both your hands on the switch.
Right. He had more strength, but I had the magic.
So then the party says, fine, we'll keep chasing Nistrum and maybe he's got some more answers for us. And you pursue him toward the observatory.
And we'll figure out how that pursuit went next week.
So this week we're talking about character death and how to deal with that and whether you should be dealing with that. So we'll be discussing above the table talk and the kinds of things that should be happening ahead of time before your first death.
I don't know.
I'll just spring it on them.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think there's a certain charm to kind of dealing with the impact in the moment of character death. It's one thing if you agree ahead of time, hey, look, we're playing Dungeon Crawl Classics. Characters are going to die. And you go, okay, we're expecting that. And there's another way where you go, all right, we're superheroes. No one dies when you're a superhero, mm-hmm. right? And you go, okay, well, we expect that. And then when you kind of throw a wrench in there, like, you know, when something happens and when it's fair, like, I think that's an interesting conversation to have at your table. So I don't know that you always have to, like, agree, am I allowed to kill your characters?
That's true. I mean, any kind of death that's not necessarily prepared for can change things a lot. I was in a teenage superhero game one time.
Oof.
And, well, yeah, it was supposed to be sort of campy.
Yeah.
And we were battling on top of like a silo and one of the other characters stabbed a guy. And then the guy failed his saves and he fell off the silo. The GM was like, well, I mean, he got stabbed and he fell 50 feet. He's dead. He's dead. And that totally changed the tone of the game.
Yeah, that's dark.
Cause, right, because now we have like this 15-year-old character who's dealing with his first murder.
Yeah. All right.
So maybe that could have used a little telegraphing earlier, or even a little retconning, honestly.
Right, right, yeah. Right. Okay, but let's talk about the more normal cases, right?
Yes, let's talk about like what's the purpose, or what should be the purpose of a death in-game.
The purpose of death is to provide tangible consequences for player slash PC actions, both in-game and above the table in real life. So for me, death is the reason the rules exist. Because at the end of the day, we were perfectly fine as children playing make-believe, right? We played cops and robbers, and we played cowboys and Indians, and we played all those different games without ever having any rules. And everybody had fun making those stories. But no one ever lost those games.
Well, if you were little, got beat up a lot, you lost those games.
Well, if you got beat up by your older brother, I mean, that's one thing. But you know, it's like you never deal with the fact that, like, okay, well, your cowboy died, right? It was always like, I shoot you. Nuh-uh. So the rules exist to allow those negative consequences to happen in a way that doesn't seem forced, right?
Right. I mean, when you're older, without that fear of death, there's usually nothing at stake in the game.
Exactly.
You know you're going to win, and so, okay, great. Why don't we just skip the dice rolling and sort of get to the end of the story? Tell us your tale, OGM.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, as adults, you hate that when there's that super campy death moment in fiction as well, right? When the character is going to die and it's been clearly telegraphed and, you know, when it happens, you're like, all right, I got to read through this, but I feel nothing.
Right. When suddenly the character who's been dodging bullets left and right gets shot through the heart and you're like, really?
Yeah.
Wait, oh, this is happening for plot reasons. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. I'm thinking of a certain
Joss Whedon sequel in which he did not own the rights to the character. R.I.P. Quicksilver.
Spoiler alert.
So what are the forms of character death then? What are the reasons that you use it or that it exists?
I think one of the most common, or at least one of the ones that players like to see if it's going to happen to their character, or if you're going to see it in game, is for emotional effect. It's either that heroic sacrifice that's been maybe built up, you know, maybe you have a character who's sort of planning on dying for the greater good, or it just might be in the moment and someone decides, you know what, I'm going to hold this door open against the encroaching horde so the rest of the party or like all the refugees can escape. And that can be an amazing moment and a great finale to a character. And then on the other end, it can just be horrible, tragic loss or similar reasons, right? You fail, but you still have that amazing emotional moment.
Yep. There's also luck of the dice. You know, sometimes sometimes you're playing Lost Mines of Phandelver and in the first encounter, the GM crits and that kills your first level character.
Yep, it happens. And I think this is pretty standard in that the GM's not out to kill your character, but they're also not fudging the dice to make sure that you don't die. And particularly at low levels, yeah, sometimes you take 36 damage from a great axe.
Yeah. It's possible, and instant death is a thing.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons that some GMs just roll with it almost like golf rules, like play where it lies, is to showcase that the game is fair, or that it is, you know, at least randomly fair.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're not pulling punches, they're not out to get you, and then, you know, whatever comes down the line, if you guys do end up losing to the BBEG, everyone knows, well, this is how this game goes. Like sometimes GMs just roll in front of the screen and you know, everyone knows, well, we got critted.
Yeah, that's, I like doing that because I feel guilty killing characters, even when it hits the emotional effect, even when it's a sacrifice that a player is making. I hate killing their characters because like I feel guilty because I know it sucks to lose a character. So whenever that happens, I'm always like, all right, I'm going to roll. I know you're low. I'm just going to roll this in the open. So we're not, you know, I didn't roll anything up to the point where you got to one hit point, but I'm certainly rolling it in the open now that you're at one hit point.
You're just trying to dodge the responsibility for the death blow.
Yeah, exactly.
It was the dice.
It's just the dice, man.
And I think that's totally valid. I don't think anyone necessarily cares that much about fudging an early skill check or like the, you know, one of the first blows in combat. But when it really comes down to like those ending death saving throws or like the athletics check to drag a companion to safety or all of those sorts of things, the last hit on the last enemy. Yeah. People want to know that like they either earned it or it was lost fairly.
Yeah, exactly. So there's also the meaningless death. and we mean that in the artful form of meaningless, right? Sort of demonstrating that it's hopeless, that death happens, that death is an ever-present risk and part of the world, and that characters will die.
Mm-hmm. This is often setting specific. I'm thinking of basically the Warhammer games.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the Imperial Guard.
One of our favorite write-ups that we've talked about, the All Guardsmen Party, uses this to excellent effect right at the beginning.
Yeah, they called it Darwinian character creation.
Right, it's just death after death after death.
Yeah, they were rolling up characters before their current characters died because it was faster that way.
Yep.
And their job was to hold the line. And if they retreated, they were killed. If they ran out of ammo, they probably died. And if they didn't, they probably died anyway. But the survivors became a sort of a motley crew of characters that they then played their campaign.
That's right, the new party.
It showed that death is ever present, but that the survivors are truly heroes, right? Mm-hmm.
I think it was a really good way of showcasing what almost all RPGs say at the beginning, which is that the PCs are special in some way.
Yeah.
You know, but everyone just sort of makes their PC and is like, oh, they're special, you know, and that's why they're here. But these particular character sheets actually were special.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an amazing idea for how to start a campaign.
I wouldn't want to run it or play in it, though.
Yeah, I would be really frustrated. And that session, I know, took like a weekend to actually create these characters. And if I played a weekend of RPGs just to end up with a handful of viable characters after rolling dozens, I would quit.
I think they'd already been playing together for like 10 years.
I know, so. I know, yeah.
And then, of course, there's truly meaningless deaths.
Yeah, that's meaningless without the artfulness.
Mm-hmm. Where there's no purpose for it. It's either done out of spite above the table, or honestly can't think of a reason to do it in game.
It's rocks fall, you die, right?
Yeah.
It's the GM kind of flexing his muscle, and I think we can both agree it's just bad GMing.
Yeah,
right.
There's no reason to do that.
Right. It's punitive, right? It's when your characters are, or when the players are maybe pushing against the rails of the story and you want to force them back onto the railroad, or they're behaving like murder hobos in a game where you're trying to take it seriously, that sort of thing, right?
And these are all things that really should have been discussed earlier rather than saying, in game, I'm wiping all of you.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely letting out-of-game issues affect characters in game.
Totally.
But it's not all loss, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There are other useful purposes for character death. It lets players switch PCs.
Or quit.
Right. Yeah, I mean, sometimes people have life things, right? We're having a baby and I just can't commit to a weekly game anymore.
Yeah, or I'm moving to a different city, yeah, or changing jobs or whatever, right?
Exactly.
I mean, that happens.
So a nice thing to do is a sort of send off, and sometimes those players want their character to die, maybe heroically, maybe tragically. You know, maybe they want them to be retired and become an NPC, but a death is a nice way to gain that closure.
Yep.
Both for the people who are losing an actual player and the player who's losing a group.
Yep.
And then, of course, after the fact, you now have both the players and the party in-game telling stories about this character that died, and it builds, or it can build, camaraderie between the people who are left.
Yeah, it throws a wrench in your role play that the characters now have to deal with. Sort of the same way you were talking about with your teen superhero game. It wasn't a character that died, but it was a character who killed, and now they had to confront death as a piece of their world.
Even though it wasn't the kind of game that we were originally intending to play, it definitely made everything more real for us, and then those characters as well. Oh, how would someone this age with these kinds of powers deal with this really emotional situation?
Right. And then you've also got the sort of avenging their death, or, you know, this creates your BBEG, like that sort of thing, right? You can get those future story hooks out of it.
Absolutely. And it can even work when it's not just one death, but if you happen to wipe the entire party, or, you know, maybe it's planned, but that can definitely set up future hooks for either a different campaign or essentially the same campaign with different characters in the same world.
If you can pull it off somehow, have your next group of adventurers stumble upon the room in which their last group of characters died and sort of uncover that result in game.
And then it sort of gives them another chance to defeat the room.
Yeah, they can kind of, Well, they can kind of pick up the story from there, right? They find the information they need to then pick up the mantle and finish what their characters had started.
Yeah, maybe this time they have slightly different skills or some sort of deus ex machina and they can solve the riddle of that Sphinx and not get torn to pieces.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the frequency. How often should characters be dying in your game?
Well, there's the typical version, which is occasionally and kind of on a random schedule. That's because it's unplanned. But if it does happen, mainly due to luck of the dice, and it isn't usually due to horribly bad luck, then the GM just sort of lets it happen. I know there are a lot of GMs who have this rule that if you weren't doing something stupid, then a natural one shouldn't kill you. You know, so if you're attempting to cross a chasm and you're doing it carefully, you might roll that one on a skill check, but you're not going to usually fall off a relatively meaningless cliff and then like just die there.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, occasionally you have enemies that have abilities that just line up poorly for that character. I mean, that happened to us in the Morning Glory campaign when I got swallowed by that aberrant T-Rex in Zendrick. I was just kind of stuck. There wasn't a whole lot I could do. And, you know, fortunately, we were able to figure out a way to avoid me being crushed to death.
I believe Bastion, the Warforged monk, ran up and punched it 4 times in the stomach.
And critted,
right? Yeah. Causing it to regurgitate you.
Yeah.
And killing it in the process.
Right.
Yeah, I think at that point it was like, just who can roll as many dice as possible?
Yeah, exactly.
Just do this.
Somebody crit and save him.
Right.
And then there's also the occasional and planned, where the death is serving story purpose.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes this is because a player has said, you know, I want my character to die. Often because they want to switch, for whatever reason. You had talked about earlier in the Morning Glory campaign, you weren't necessarily sure if Brand is supposed to, or would, stick around with this party. And of course, you weren't going to, as a player, derail it. You were just going to retire Brand.
Yeah, he was going to teleport off into the sunset.
Right. Or, you know, maybe die horribly depending on.
But he's going to teleport off into the sunset.
He's going to teleport off into the sun.
he's going to teleport to the retirement home for old inquisitors.
False destination. Wow, it rolled false destination 10 times. Man, that's a lot of damage. Fortunately, Brand didn't go away.
Yeah, I think that one falls under meaningless.
But I did this in our 4E game. I was playing a ranger, and I was having a decent amount of fun with it, but it was getting a little repetitive for me, and I thought that there were some holes in the party that could be filled, you know, skill-wise and in terms of combat, because, you know, 4E was so combat-heavy. The combats were taking so long, we just really needed someone to sort of move them along.
Yep.
So,
I mean, as 4E does.
Yeah. So I worked with Angelo, our GM, and he had my character killed in a relatively heroic way, sort of sacrificed himself to defeat a big evil that we were trying to contain in some way. But then that turned him into a revenant, which was a playable race later on in 4E, which is basically a character who comes back from the dead. And that worked really well because I just sort of reformed with all the new gear that was applicable to this new character and build, because, you know, it was sort of like a magic death.
And like a best actor Oscar as well.
I don't think I did a very good job of that. But,
oh, no.
But in retrospect, right, people remember it being pretty heroic.
Yeah. Every paladin or cleric every holy character that I play, I always intend to die for story purposes. I'm always looking for the angle where I die for my god, where I make the greatest sacrifice for my deity.
I mean, why else play a holy character, honestly?
How I feel. Because, you know, I mean, I certainly wouldn't die for my god in real life. So it's a fun little departure.
It's called role-playing.
Right.
It's sort of the same thing for Shiv, who is my untouchable character in our Dark Heresy game. He's got his brother, your character, Bones, who he sort of shields with his blank aura. And I've sort of decided in 40K you have these fate points and you can use them to avoid inevitable death.
Yeah, you can burn them to cheat death.
Right, a certain number of times. And Shiv has a fair number of them. He's still got 3 left. But I've decided that if Bones actually dies, because he's kind of running out of fate points,
Hey.
If he actually dies and then Shiv dies, he's just going to die. Because there's not really a reason for his existence anymore, in his mind.
Right, right. Yeah. And then there's constant death. This is your classic dungeon crawl, or your literal dungeon crawl classics mm-hmm. game.
This is really, everyone is probably already on board because you know what kind of game you're playing. You know, we are working through old school Tomb of Horrors.
Right, right.
Bring back ups.
Yeah, we talked about this in our one-shot discussion. This mm-hmm. is the sort of dungeon challenge kind of adventure where if you fail, death is the outcome, and everyone's kind of on board with that.
Mm-hmm. And it's more likely in dice-driven games, not story-driven games, which is why the consequences of that character dying aren't as bad.
I'll disagree with you there because Fiasco exists. And almost everyone ends up dead in Fiasco.
Fiasco is the exception to almost every rule.
That's true, yeah. And then finally, there's some games just characters never die. There's just very little threat and they're expected to never really die.
Right. And sometimes this is purposeful. It's sort of like playing a character who's like Superman. There's always a way that Superman is going to figure out to win. You know, there's not really a way to hurt him. The drama comes from literally everything else in the universe sort of being at stake and being more vulnerable than he is.
Yeah, this is like your fifth edition druid at high levels. They're basically unkillable, but you can certainly do a lot of damage to a lot of things they hold dear.
Yeah, you can burn down their entire forest while they're away.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and in some ways, that can be much worse than just killing the character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, there's just sort of de facto never dying, which is something that a good GM attempts to mitigate. And this is at many high-level games. Once you become very powerful, you just have so many different ways to either avoid death or come back from death or foresee it or whatever.
Well, I mean, the power creep at high levels happens in just about every game because mm-hmm. high levels should be a reward, right?
Right.
And you shouldn't have the same fear of death. Why are you high level now?
And of course, if you're planning your character in-game properly, probably if you've been around for a long time in a universe where everything is trying to kill you, you've gotten very good at not dying.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, even if you do die, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's got to last forever. This is often fantasy or sci-fi.
Oh, yeah. So the most D&D-centric one is just resurrection. I mean, there are dozens of ways to prevent characters who are dead from ever leaving the game in right. D&D, starting from third-level spells, right?
In many editions, yes. And then fourth or fifth level is when Raise Dead really kicks in.
Yep.
And at that point, it's just let's pay to not die or to have not had to deal with those consequences.
Right, right.
At least long term. And that is a thing that really changes the dynamic of a game. And it's sort of built into the D&D system. So it's really hard to get around it without stripping out all those come back from the dead spells. And that sells many builds and many kinds of characters short, so it's tough to take out.
Or you could create either magical items or artifacts or plot contrivances that prevent resurrection, right? You mm-hmm. could, something that drinks a character's soul, for like a demon who drinks souls would mm-hmm. prevent Raise Dead, for example.
And I'd say that's something, like if that is prominent in your setting, you do need to tell your players ahead of time because they're going to be picking things and you don't want to get to level 11 and then suddenly find out that like your class feature doesn't do anything.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair.
Thanks.
There's also the sort of plot armor death where you draw the end of the scene before the outcome is known or confirmed. So rocks fall. Do you die? We'll find out next week. Or perhaps we'll find out in a few months when that character resumes. It's that classic TV move where you kill off a character for contract concerns and then you bring him back a couple seasons later because you didn't show the character actually die. You just sort of implied that he died.
We didn't see a body.
Right. Yeah. Glenn from Walking Dead.
And then there's death is only the beginning. This is the kind of death that needs to occur in order to move the story forward. And the system that I'm thinking of in specific is Phoenix Dawn Command.
Yes.
Where the mechanism for leveling up is death, and you get stronger as you come back, but you've only got 7 lives, so once you run out of them, you're dead.
Yeah, yeah. The method for leveling up is actually sacrifice. It has to be a worthwhile death. And then sometimes death is just a very temporary setback.
Sometimes it's not even a setback.
Yeah.
Like in Eclipse Phase.
Yeah, where you've already cloned yourself. You've already uploaded your memory banks. You just have to call the corporation to plug them together.
That's right.
This is why sci-fi settings hurt my head.
Which is worse, having one real grandma die or having 10,000 copies of her, or 9,999 copies of her die horribly, but one still is alive?
That's a cultural question.
Yeah.
How much do you value those backups compared to the original thing? I mean, I imagine in a culture with backups that widespread, the original would be extremely valuable.
Or the complete opposite. All the copies are equal to the original in value.
That would just be so inflationary. How could you possibly afford that many copies?
Well, in Eclipse Phase, you buy them with rep.
We have significantly diverged.
But yes, in this instance, it's a bit like the comic book mentality. It's not about do you survive, because it's almost impossible not to survive. You have to almost try to die in Eclipse Phase.
Yeah.
But lots of other bad things can happen. You know, the extinction of the human race, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then there's also mitigated death, right? This is, we talk about the 40K RPGs or Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, where you've got fate points and you can burn them to cheat death. Just, this would kill you, but by some miracle, it doesn't.
This is one of my favorite mechanisms, and I always think about porting it over into other systems that I'm running, because it's nice to be able to say, I'm going to try to do this heroic thing or this crazy thing, and not sit there and try to do all of the statistics on the what are my odds of actually failing this, because, you know, I don't want to lose this character. It gives you license to be heroic, and at least a few times over the course of this character's life, you can cheat death. And, you know, once you're burning your fourth fate point, it's like, well, I have had a good run.
Yeah, yeah. When you're out of fate points to burn, everything becomes a lot more dangerous, right? The other thing I really like about the way burning fate works in those systems specifically is that the lead up to character death, the critical damage that causes character death, is so devastating that you don't get out with no consequences. At one point, we had a character who was beheaded and he burned fate to survive. So we had to figure out, like, oh my God, how did that happen? And what does it take to actually get him back on his feet, right, from beheading?
What kind of painful cybernetics does he need installed?
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you could have lost limbs. You could, you know, there could be lasting effects, even though you have managed to cheat fate. So I like that there's still heavy consequences to death and you're still desperately trying to avoid it, even though you have this kind of life raft.
Yeah, it's definitely possible to end up with critical effects that are so bad that your character is nearly unplayable.
Right. Yeah. Well, or you're spending so much resources on cybernetics, and then you die on the operating table. Because sometimes death is meaningless.
And then, of course, there is the forever and ever dead. That's pretty rare, I think, in RPGs these days. Like the, hey, you're dead and there's no way to come back. I'm thinking of Star Wars.
Yeah, Star Wars does it as a setting. I mean, I think there's a lot of the kind of gritty realist settings that do that. And sometimes the systems don't necessarily line up well with that setting in that regard. But Apocalypse World, I don't think, or the Powered by the Apocalypse doesn't generally have a resurrection.
Dungeon World does. I had a character that came back to life.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I think the cleric had some ability that let me come back to life within a certain amount of time, but like I was dead.
Yeah, I mean, that's a kind of a setting appropriate thing,
right?
But, you know, I mean, if you're playing a post-apocalyptic setting or whatever, reviving the dead is sort of...
It's a waste of food.
Right.
Of course, once you've got a dead character or you think you might soon have a dead character, there are ways to avoid or mitigate some of the negative consequences that you're probably going to have to deal with. Like, for example, your player has their character die. Now they're bored. They don't have anything to do for the rest of the session.
Yeah, it sucks to kill a character in the first combat.
Ooh, yeah.
And it's like, is there an NPC you can play?
Right, yeah. Hey, why don't you start rolling up a new one?
Yeah, exactly.
Leaf through the books and like not really be here. You could have done this at home.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Right.
So you want to get a jump on traffic, yeah.
But there are some things that you can do temporarily or in the meantime. Of course, I'm thinking one of my favorite is reincarnation. Is don't worry, and then the crazy druid runs up and says, I got this, you'll be fine, and then creates a new body for you randomly.
Oh, it's going to be really nice when you're playing a squirrel for the rest of the session.
5e limits it to, I think, maybe 10 different humanoid races, but I always like to remember reincarnation as a good option for backstory, because if you want to have a character that doesn't fit the typical mold, think of, for example, a bladesinger who dies and then is reincarnated but isn't an elf.
Yeah, I like that.
Or a battle rager who isn't a dwarf or something like that.
Sure.
Are they allowed to continue? All these kinds of things. And it's nice to be able to go, oh, that's why your dragon mark doesn't match your race.
Mm.
And I think in 3.5 Eberron, it actually called out that's one of the very few ways that you can get a dragon mark that doesn't match your race is you got reincarnated.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, again, that's a little bit of a Benny Hill, Yaggedy Sax, what are you going to be?
Yeah.
When I was a teenager, I ended up a polar bugbear.
Oh, so there's that.
Yeah, I got a +4 to stealth in
Arctic
locations, yes, if I covered my nose.
It's a +8 if you cover your nose.
It's also kind of a pain to incorporate these new PCs into your story, especially if you've been going for like a year.
Yeah, we've talked about that in the past,
mm-hmm.
About the challenges around that. But yes, that is certainly one thing to consider when characters die. You've also got this sudden lack of party cohesion, right? Mm-hmm. You have to introduce a new character and then not just give him reasons to follow along and join this quest, but also reasons for the party to accept that character.
Right. You often end up with this weird situation where the party basically picks up a mercenary at the tavern and is like, oh, by the way, we're saving the world and here's all the information about that and we trust you implicitly.
Right, yeah.
When you were deciding whether or not Brand was going to continue, we spent, I think, weeks sort of figuring out, okay, if this does happen, how is this new character going to come in? Where are they going to come in? If you're going to get rid of Brand, it can't happen until like about 3 weeks from now when there'll be an opportunity for that.
Right. And then that never ended up happening.
Yeah, but it was good practice for me.
Yep.
So I sort of have a few hooks for pulling in a new character and getting rid of an old one that I can use in the future.
Yeah, and then you've also got this interruption of a story that was in progress, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in most large campaigns, or long-term campaigns rather, characters develop their own sort of side interests, mm-hmm. right? You know, a character might have a particular affinity for an NPC or a town or that sort of thing, right? Or have made a commitment to somebody sort of tangentially. Now, if that character dies, that's sort of just left out there floating. And the other characters might not have any reason to really go follow up on it.
Or they might have every reason that they really are missing that now because that PC was the only one who really had access to this particular town or this merchant's guild
or something
like that. Or the person they owed favors to is now come a calling.
Yeah, exactly. They've now inherited their friend's debts.
That's
kind of
right.
Thing. Yeah, so you've got to figure out all these loose ends. How do you tie them up or tie them together so that they either get picked up or they're kind of reach a satisfying end?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's kind of an epilogue or maybe letters from home or, you know, that sort of thing where you find out what happened and you can move on.
I really like PC graveyards.
Here lies.
Right. We bought a plot on the astral.
And then the last thing to consider, upset players.
Yeah, definitely happens.
Because I know for me, I didn't even die. I lost an arm. And I was pissed. Like, I took it personal. Like, I wasn't mad at you, right? It was fair. But I was pissed. Like, I was so disappointed that my beloved character was now, like, gimped. He was
unarmed.
Not handicapped in the, you know, disabled sort of way. But, like, I felt like he had one less thing that he was capable of on his character sheet.
I mean, he had one less slot.
Yeah, exactly. He had, like, now I couldn't carry a shield and mm-hmm. a wand.
Your Warcaster feat was kind of
worthless. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And of course, I only did that. You didn't know this at the time, right? But I only did that knowing that very quickly there were going to be options for you to mitigate that or fix it.
Yeah. And then, Well, I made a deal with the devil to accelerate that even faster. Yes. I didn't even play one session without it.
Right. But if you're doing this right, the player should be upset. Not in a bad way.
Yeah. They should be invested in their characters enough that they feel an emotional response when their character dies.
Right. Even if they know it's coming, there should be this sense of loss, which is sort of the point of the ritualized nature of getting rid of the old character and bringing in the new one.
Yeah, which I think this goes back to what I was saying, where I always want to roll that killing blow in the open. Mm. It's kind of an emotional intelligence thing, right? It's a, I'm sorry I'm killing your character. You know, I know this sucks for you, but it's happening. As opposed to the gleeful DM hiding behind the screen who's like, ha ha, you're dead, right? It's like you're being taunted by the guy who you're supposed to be having fun with.
Yeah, and it just undermines your own game.
Yeah.
You're like, why are you emotionally invested in the story that I'm telling?
Yeah, idiot. It's like everyone knows you should be cynical.
Yeah. Don't be that person.
So I have a question of form for you.
Okay.
How do you feel about the DM targeting dying characters so that they actually die, even though they're kind of effectively out of the fight?
So you mean like the PC has dropped to zero or below zero, they're on the ground. And usually what happens is the enemy, whoever it is, then moves on to the next sort of active character and starts attacking them.
Yeah, and that's sort of the tradition of role-playing games, right? Is you, if you're going to kill a single character in combat, he either fails his death saves or whatever and dies that way, or you get a TPK and there's no one left to save them.
Right. But if you think about it from an in-game perspective, sometimes that doesn't make sense. Now, you know, sometimes a pack of wolves will drag off a dying character because they want to eat them.
Right, yeah.
Sometimes the BBEG really hates this character and definitely wants to make sure they're dead.
Yeah, if you send an assassin after a character, the assassin, as long as they're confident in their own self-preservation, right, they should put on the damage that kills the character.
They coup de grace.
Exactly.
That's, yes, I think usually in the heat of battle, most people don't go, okay, that guy dropped to the ground, but I don't know if he's dead. I better cut off his head. In the meantime, I'm getting flanked by four other people.
Yeah.
I think they usually, you know, you take out the biggest threat, and the biggest threat is someone who's currently conscious.
Sure.
If a battle drags out and there's a good healer who keeps popping people back up, I think a smart enemy will go, oh, I better kill people.
Right.
I better make sure they are down.
Yep.
So, yes, I'm definitely fine with it in those situations. The first time that happens, you may need to explain, hey, everybody, you're being held hostage or whatever. Yes, they're going to slit your throat or something along those lines.
Yeah, it's almost like you want to have the assassin say, like, you know, the Cult of Tiamat sends their regards or whatever, right? So it's like you understand, like, you have been targeted.
Right, I call you out by name.
Right, exactly.
Right, and then of course everyone else goes, "Oh, crap! They're they might actually die."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But then, like the flip side, right? I feel like the worst incidental death is when you've got a character making death saves, and then an enemy spellcaster just throws an AoE effect, and it's like you're not even trying to kill that character; he's just caught in the crossfire, and you're like, "Well, he certainly wouldn't care that you're in the crossfire, but ugh, this is the lamest way to go."
Right. I think what I might do in that situation is, if I were running, have the spellcaster cast the AoE, but have them target a cluster of active PCs. So that way the PCs know, okay, there are AoEs going on. The person who's down on the ground should be thinking, oh crap, please don't let me get caught in those, because that's an auto death save. Hey everybody, can someone please heal me?
Yeah. Like, just, I know this, so your guys would know this.
Right, exactly. And then once that's out in the open, then all bets are off, because you guys had that information and you chose to leave your friend bleeding on the ground when fire was exploding in the air.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's a decision everybody has to make, how much they want to roleplay those enemies and how much they just want to be player friendly in the way they run those combats, because certainly you can get TPKs without trying.
Yeah, if you really don't want to make this decision on your own, just summon a few Hezrus.
Yeah, right.
And then, you know, it says right in the stack block they're gonna eat those corpses.
He's dead. Yep. All right, do you hear that, Ishan?
I think that's the sound of crunchy bones.
It's also the sound of the character creation forge. Before we move on to the forge, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan, at Evil Sans Carne, that's Malice Minus Meat.
And you can tweet at the show, at TPTcast.
You can also email us if you can't fit it into 140 characters at totalpartythrill@gmail.com.
And finally, you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrillcast.com.
So this week in the Forge, we promised you a mounted knight. And let us say that 5e is not a system that is conducive to playing a mounted character.
No, and this is going to be a total DM fiat kind of build, because at the end of the day, if the DM sticks you in a dungeon with 10-foot wide hallways, you're not mounted. It's just your combat isn't going to be mounted.
Right. So there are a few ways that you can mitigate this, and there are a few options for mounts that aren't or are less GM dependent. So we're going to go through that, and then we're going to run through some of the other options that you can sort of run by your GM that we think are pretty reasonable. So a mounted knight needs ready access to some sort of steed. Ideally not dependent on the GM, but as you get to higher levels, it kind of has to be.
Yeah. So that's the fine steed spell.
Right. They also should be good at fighting while mounted, and, well, not just good at it, but ideally they should prefer doing it. We don't want a build where, honestly, they'd just be better getting off the horse.
Yeah.
Because it's just a pain and it's kind of a gimmick. So the build is, it's a bit odd, but bear with us. Lore Bard 9, Devotion Paladin 11.
So because Devotion Paladin gets fine steed, we're obviously going to start there, right?
We are not.
What?
We're actually going to start with 9 levels of Bard, Lore Bard. And this is because Bard is one of the best classes.
I'm listening.
So at level 6, Bard gets magical secrets. Now, the Paladin is a half caster, so, and Fighting Steed is level 2. So if you want to get that spell, you still need to have 5 levels of Paladin. So you can't even cast Fighting Steed until you get there. But when you start out as a Bard, you get Fighting Steed at level 6. You're only delaying it by 1 level. That's not so bad. But what you're really doing is gunning for Bard 9, which gets you the Awaken spell. We'll get to that later, but it's the long con.
Right.
So you also get expertise from Bard. We're going to suggest animal handling, which makes sense, but also persuasion. We'll also get to that.
Yeah. So again, building towards level 9.
That's right. At level 6, magical secrets take fine steed because it is really excellent at low levels and really terrible at high levels.
Yeah. I mean, as most of those spells are.
Right. And then the shield spell, which again, we'll get to. So fine steed is, again, level 2 paladin spell. It conjures a mount, celestial, fiendish, or fey, your choice, that you can ride, and it's loyal to you. You can share spells. Anything you cast on yourself can also affect the steed. And a nice thing about it is if it dies, you can just cast the spell again. It takes 10 minutes, and it's resummoned with full hit points. Of course, the steed only gets like a dozen hit points, so it's pretty much like a one-shot kill. And you know, if it dies, okay, you can bring it back faster than your fighter can, you know, refresh his maneuvers. That's fine. But since it doesn't scale at all, it's a little bit like riding a balloon. You know, you're just kind of terrified that anything is going to pop it and it's going to disappear out from under you.
Yeah.
Now, one way to mitigate that is the mounted combat feat, which you're going to want to take as pretty much as quickly as possible. That lets you, with no action, redirect any attack that targets your steed to you. So the idea is to pump your own AC as high as possible with plate mail, shield, ideally both magical, and so shield in one hand, lance in the other, and the shield spell. So anyone who targets your mount, you redirect to yourself, and then it hopefully misses.
Okay, but to use the shield spell, you have to have a free hand, and you're supposed to be having a shield and a lance. So we're going to start as variant human and go ahead and take Warcaster at level 1, right?
Yep, we told you there are a bunch of hoops to jump through.
Yeah. So that delays your mounted combatant until level 4, which is fine because you won't get fine steed until level 6.
Right. Now, when you're on the steed, mounted combatant also gives you advantage on any creatures that aren't mounted that are smaller than your steed. And since your steed's going to be large, that's most humanoid creatures.
Yep.
Remember this because if there are ways to get a bigger steed or to make your steed bigger, that also helps.
Yes.
And then after that, you're just taking Paladin mainly for the saving throw aura. Mountain Combatant also gives your mount evasion, or something equivalent to evasion. So if they succeed on their saving throw versus...
whatever dex, a targeting effect or constitution target. Yeah.
Fireball, for
lightning
example.
Lightning bolt, fireball, whatever.
Right. They don't take any damage if they succeed. Half damage if they fail, but ideally you want them to succeed. But since they're a pretty low level likely animal anyway, you're going to want to bump their saving throws as much as possible with your aura.
And then they'll also get immunity to Charm and Frightened, mm-hmm. which is a big boon for many of the mental effects that your mount is going to be pretty weak at defending against, being as he's some form of animal.
Right. But what you're really going for is Fine Steed is just to tide you over. At level 9, you get Awaken, which is a bard and druid spell which lets you target a plant or a beast up to huge size, which then gains an intelligence of 10, it can speak a language, and it's charmed by you for 30 days. Be really nice to it.
Yeah, be super nice.
Save its life a bunch.
And even if you're having trouble being nice to it, you've got expertise in persuasion.
Exactly. That's why you took that.
Right.
Because it's intelligent now. It's not animal handling.
Right.
After the 30 days, make your persuasion check and convince it, hey, you know what? We make a really good team. And I think you should let me ride you.
Yeah.
Think of all the good / bad things we could do together.
Yeah, exactly. You're like Kit to my Knight Rider.
Yeah. And one thing that you should make clear to them, once you're riding them, any attack directed toward them, you just redirect to yourself.
Yep.
It's the safest place for them to be.
True, true.
Honestly, we should rewrite the bodyguard so that they ride their charge.
Yeah.
So the best thing to awaken is actually a T-Rex. Tyrannosaurus, I believe it's CR8.
Sounds right.
It's got a plus 10 to hit, which is pretty decent throughout. It's got multi-attack. And remember, it's intelligent. So as a mount, it does its own thing.
Okay, hang on, no. As a mount, remember, it's awesome.
Right, it's riding a T-Rex. A smart T-Rex who speaks a language.
Right, right. He speaks your language.
Right, whatever you want. I like Elven. Maybe Elven would be good.
Yeah.
It'd be pretty handy. The T-Rex can also bite and then grapple, which is nice. But they get their own actions and they operate on their own initiative, so they can move around. And then you can direct them to move as well, to have them move very quickly.
Yep.
Or they can attack and then you can attack. It's all great. If your GM says, no, there are no dinosaurs, or no, you can't find a T-Rex to awaken, I suggest just going the plant route.
Yeah, you could get a treant.
Mm-hmm. Get a huge, just find a huge tree, awaken that. You've got a really stingy GM if they say, no, the huge tree that you just awakened doesn't get the stats of the huge treant that's already in the book.
Right,
which
yeah.
are literally awakened trees.
In which case, you're probably going to find like an elephant or something.
Yeah, mammoth, I think, is like CR7 or something like that, which, yeah, easier to find. And you probably have training in nature anyway because you're a bard.
Right.
You're lore bard. You can find an elephant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, if you're playing Mounted Combat as your build in 5e, you need to have your DM on board because it's, you know, so let him enable you to do cool things or her.
Right. The other option, the best flying mount that you can get with Awaken is a giant eagle. It's only, I think, CR1.
But it flies.
But it does fly. And it's neutral good, so it's probably more likely, easier to convince to help you on a noble quest.
Yeah, and maybe like we'll stick around in your stable in case you need him, you know, fly the One Ring into Mordor, drop it in the...
And that would be handy, they just had Awaken.
Right.
There's one other alternative, which we only really mentioned because it's almost all Ranger.
And it's... probably the best way to play the Beastmaster, as it were.
Maybe the only way to play the Beastmaster.
Yeah, you take a small race, you take the Beastmaster Ranger to 19. You start with Rogue One, of course. But you take 19 levels of Beastmaster Ranger, and you want to take either a Panther or a Pterodon.
Mm-hmm. If you want to fly the Pterodon. The Panther has the highest strength, and there's a possible bonus attack. It's unlikely, but possible.
Yeah, and then you put it in Plate Barding, which is the maximum armor that you can give to a mount, and
to a mount with a strength of 14. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and then you're basically playing a similar but generally weaker version of our Paladin Bard.
Right. Your little So, and your mount is medium, so you can fit in those little dungeon crawls.
That's true. That's true. That is definitely the most dungeon friendly mounted.
Right. Toward the...
Well, second most.
Toward the higher levels, though, the scaling's pretty bad because your beast is always only a CR 1/4 creature base. And it gets, you know, some decent bumps on HP and attack bonuses and saving throws, but eh.
Yeah, yeah.
But really what you should be doing is looking for a better steed.
Yeah, like perhaps a steed who has PC levels.
Aha, because the only requirement for mounted combat or for riding a mount is that they are larger than you and willing.
So I'm imagining the halfling riding the druid into combat, you know, just kind of sitting on his shoulders, just being carried along, right?
Or just a circle of the moon druid who is whatever size you want.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, and then he B-shapes and...
can still cast spells.
Right.
And remember, you get advantage against attacks that any non-mounted creature that is smaller than your mount. So if your druid can become huge or larger, that's even better.
Yeah, there's also the wizard...
with polymorph
or just shape. The enlarge spell.
Right, because remember, your wizard probably won't need to make concentration checks. You're redirecting all attacks to yourself.
Yep.
Ride your wizard.
It's actually a really safe way to go for the sorcerer as well.
Mm.
If he polymorphs himself and then twin spell to polymorph the fighter so she can be a T-Rex.
Oh.
Right, then you've then got two T-Rexes safe. And you're also taking over the concentration saves. Or taking the damage away, so she doesn't have to concentrate.
That's great.
Yeah.
You've got the awakened creature option.
Yep. And then just in a pinch, you know, any PC really that's bigger than you will allow you to use your mounted combat feat and your shield and lance attacks.
Yeah, and if they're not already larger than you, like we said, enlarge makes them large enough.
Yeah, and this is where you get full-on Benny Hill mode.
Right. It's very old man in the sea.
Yeah.
Notice that there is an exotic saddle. And it's just made specially for any type of thing that you might mount, like a griffin or a hippogriff or another PC.
Or a tree.
Yeah, exactly. You just need to go have it made.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe it doubles the cost, but okay, now it's, what, 100 gold pieces?
Yeah, if this seems like we're pulling at the fringes of the rules here to make this work, it's because we absolutely are. Because
we have to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't even offer you... a character concept that embraces these things.
I've got one.
Okay, what do you got?
It's Eberron specific.
Oh, even better.
Yeah. So she is a halfling from the Talenta Plains who fought in the last war against the forces of Karnath, the undead forces of Karnath, and she lost her legs.
Oh.
Amputee.
Okay.
So
okay.
She has to be mounted. In fact, she's used to being carried around.
In like a litter sort of thing.
Right. Or... you know, just random humans or elves who will sort of give her a ride because she's a war hero.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, she doesn't have any legs.
Well, I mean, until level 14 when she 14. Gets regeneration.
Right. Not there yet. And after, by then, you know, she's used to not having legs, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe. Or she puts swords on her legs.
Something like that. Yeah.
Something like that. But anyway, she already has this sort of saddle devoted toward riding a humanoid.
Okay. Because
that's kind of how she gets around.
Yep.
You know, people are okay with it.
She's got the baby Bjorn. Got it.
That's right. And she says, you know what? I hate this. I hate this and I want to get back out there. So steed. Steed is the way to go. And then she says to herself, well, we've got a lot of dinosaurs. I need
that's
find-
where the Talenta Plains come in.
That's
okay.
Exactly.
All right.
It.
Now I understand.
Because
okay.
The halfling outriders already ride dinosaurs.
Right, right, right.
She okay. says, you know what? Let's go big or go home.
Fair enough.
I'm finding a T-Rex.
Yeah. And if you can argue without legs, she's size small.
She's already size small. She's halfling.
Oh, halfling.
We're good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, why not be a variant human?
Because they don't come from the Talenta Plains.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah.
Although you could be variant human from House Vidalis because they actually ride griffins.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So you take animal handling, you take expertise in that, and yeah. Then you just train one from an egg.
That makes sense. All right, if you want to support the show, the easiest way to do that is to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And if you're willing to help us out, we'll read your 5-star review on the air.
You can also find us on Stitcher. It's like a Pandora for podcasts. If you like or favorite us there, the algorithm will help other people find us.
And would you like to read our 5-star review from iTunes?
Yeah. This is It's All Right, I Guess, 5 stars by DM Starhelm. Nah, I'm just kidding. This podcast is great. I really enjoy listening, and although I don't always agree with the opinions and thoughts put forth by hosts Shane and Ishan, I am often inspired by their tales from the Morning Glory campaign, or from whatever topic they happen to be discussing. At first, I didn't care for the character creation forge, mostly because I'm not a big fan of my experiences with multiclassing. But it's grown on me, and the discussions about the backstory and fiction of the character concepts has inspired me even when the mechanics did not. Also, I got to meet Shane at a catacomb. My best friend ran the Whose Quest Is It Anyways game, and while I didn't get to play with you the first night, I took over for your character on the second night. And he was a genuinely awesome dude, which makes me appreciate the podcast even more. 5 out of 5 stars.
The first person I've ever met who called me genuinely awesome.
Probably the last.
With good reason. But yes, thank you so much for the kind words.
I'm glad that the changes that we made to the forge, it seems like people like.
Yeah, and I really enjoy kind of building that character concept, the backstory part of it as well. So it's been fun to do that. It's a little more creative, mm-hmm. A little less problem solving. Though sometimes it's just as much problem solving, right? We're solving the problem of how does this make sense?
Or how does this concept, how does this work?
Yeah.
Doesn't. Okay, wait.
All right, so what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about salvaging the pieces of a dead campaign.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
Well, speaking of dead things, we're building a corpse reviver.
Charming. Well, that's it for episode 24 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.